And the
podcast
begins with a song of rebellion.
How can this
podcast
be my life?
CD Burners.
Do you know any Einstein Kill songs?
No.
They're one of those bands that's like fucking people like love them.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what?
I just had one of the guys at emo night this past weekend. His name was Ricky. And he was at Omaha and it went crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
The fuck? Hold on, let's do like one thing.
One Google?
No. Let's see. Ice Spice. Nine kills.
Ice Spice kills.
Alright, let's just like three. Alright. It's like fuck, what would I put that with?
I See Stars.
Another one where I was like, what? Like, that one, like, kind of also fell into the, how do you say Spitalfield?
You said it right. I said it wrong.
What were you saying?
Spitalfield.
At Spitalfield?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to have the spit in it.
Yeah. All right, great. That fell into the thing that I didn't know, you know?
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to CD Burners. Today, we're talking about The Used. In Love and Death, the second studio album from the band from Orem, Utah. This album was recorded.
Orem sounds like a body part.
Orem, I hardly know
him. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, it's by like Provo.
Is it a fairly religious city?
Oh yeah, big time. It was released September 28th, 2004, and it was certified platinum, which means it sold over a million copies.
Yeah, that's fucking nuts.
It is their most commercially successful album to date. This album has a lot of tragedy surrounding it because Bert lost two friends, including an ex-girlfriend who was carrying his child. So he lost the girlfriend and the baby and another friend.
I read that it was like related. Like none of the songs were written about that, but this happened. They were recording it at the time.
There were definitely like songs about her. I don't think it was about the death per se. Maybe there was one or two, but there were definitely like songs about their relationship. Her name is Katie, and they broke up, but they decided to have the baby anyway. And then she died of a drug overdose.
Well, give me some more information about this, because I have some strongly opinionated things to say. Like, looking up this album and this band in particular for how cult their fans are, and like you said, platinum, and for as fucking massive as they were in, like, in my eyes and the people around me, my mind's eyes, you gotta, like, be like, oh, the dead internet theory truly exists. Like, their shit is getting wiped off of the internet. It is very difficult to find some stuff that you think would be readily available about The Used and this album. Like, not, or it's, like, on page fucking 400 of Google, because it's really difficult to, like, get the...
You have to use the Wayback Machine. You have to look at the archives, and you have to read the articles. Like... A lot of them, yes, are wiped. I also think, I don't know why, but I feel like The Used should be as big as like My Chemical Romance, if not bigger. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they never went away. Like, they've continued to make music.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't really like let the demand build. And I think that that's, you know, a huge reason why My Chemical Romance is as big as they are now is because they went away for a while. The Used never stopped.
Sometimes all you have to do is stop. Sometimes the best thing to do is nothing.
Yeah.
Sometimes the answer to, but here's the thing about those guys and, you know, Bert in particular, he's a word guy. Like, as he looks at the world, like, as art, you know? Yeah. And I think that for somebody who looks at the world like that, it's really hard to stop making things.
He's a genuine artist.
It's really hard to stop. I know, like, I really relate a lot to him. That's why I do, like, these weird side quests, like, sometimes, like, when we have so much shit going on. because I'm like, I have to do something else. So to stop doing anything, to stop doing the thing that like, I could see it being really difficult. And I think that that's, you know, for better or for worse, it is just what it is. And I know they've done some albums that they're like, yeah, we just put this out. It was a whatever album. It wasn't critically acclaimed. And then there's some albums they put out that they're like, dude, we love this so much. And we really tried something new and, you know, it was not well received. And then there's ones that are like, we didn't try and it was well received. And, you know, I think they just continuously tried different stuff. And I really like that. I remember one time he came to you and I and like read a poem for like 2 minutes.
Yeah, dude. It was, I think at Emo Night Day, he literally just started saying poetry. He also, dude, like, I remember him like calling out MGK. We had MGK play on the main stage and then we had Bert and I think it was Quinn or somebody on the B stage and they performed acoustic and Bert went into like a monologue of reciting poetry for a really long time. And then he was also like talking shit. But then I think MGK and ended up like doing something together.
Look, I mean,
they squashed that beef.
Maybe. But the like, I really like this dude. I get it.
Yeah, Body Bag featuring Youngblood and Burt McCracken.
Yeah, there you go. They squashed it. Maybe that was us. Maybe that was us again.
Maybe.
When did that come out? Did that come out after?
It came out with like Tickets to My Downfall and all that.
So yes, that came out after we did it. We squashed the beef. We did that. Another thing. Credit to Emo Night that Wikipedia won't ever put on there. Nobody will ever know. Like a blanket statement about The Used is like, I remember hearing this on the radio for the first time. Like, I remember this was the first song.
Which song? That
I heard screaming on the radio.
What song?
Bro, I don't fucking know what song. Whatever song made it to radio.
I don't know.
All That I've Got. I don't know. One of them. But like, okay. I remember it was like, and it was the, whatever song off this album was the first one that made it to radio was that. And I was like, that was the first time I heard like screaming on radio the way that I wanted screaming to sound. You know, because before it was like I listened to a lot of metal and it never sounded like this. It, you know, it's screaming, but it's in like a different way. It's like more guttural and like.
Yeah, this is, he's a great singer as well.
There's a lot of stuff and there's something that's indescribable that you can hear as a drug addict listening to another drug addict, not knowing if they are or not. It's one of those things that I've always said. If you like put like 10 people in front of me and they're like, one of them, like all of them are like, had nothing wrong with them. And one of them had something that we'd always like pick that.
Well, why do you think Feldman and Bert like hit it off so well?
It's, but like, I didn't know anything about The Used and I instantly was like, oh, this is what, I love this. And I really can tell that this guy's not lying. He's not phony.
He's giving it his all.
It really like giving it his all, but in a way that is sincere and not put together like some of the other or bands of that time where I was like, this sounds like they went into the studio and like had to do this. This album to me sounded like a necessity. And like, that's what I heard the first time I heard it on the radio. He also had literally my favorite voice. And it was a unique in a way. I think a lot of times people go, yeah, they're, you know, this album is great because they have a unique voice. And when you say unique, you're kind of going like, it's a little annoying and different and weird.
They can't sing.
Yeah, it's like, I think that's like a, who's that? Jewel? Yeah. You know, it's like, that's unique.
When you talk about Connor Oberst, he's got a unique voice.
He sounds like a goat.
Can't sing.
He sounds like a goat, you know?
And love
like,
Connor.
But. I love it. It's like, yeah, but that's like how a reviewer would be like, unique. But like, this was unique in a way that was very good.
Yeah. He has almost like the vibrato thing that Post Malone does.
Oh, Connor?
No. Bert.
Connor does too, kinda.
Kinda, but like, Post and Bert hit the notes.
Yeah, Connor. Connor's not like a goat. Yeah. I like it. I love it. But I mean, like, it was the thing is, like, in general, I was like, oh, this, you know, these guys give a shit. It felt real. It, like, resonated with me right away. there is an attitude, an ego, and an insanity that you can hear in Bert that if you, like I said, if you are a drug addict or alcoholic, like it hits you right away where you're like, oh yeah, I know. And it's like sonar, you know, and those things, like not necessarily, those things are not necessarily bad. Like, you know, we look at ego as, you can tell when you're listening to the songs, it's like there has to be a little of the ego there because that's what gets you into these things. That's what gets you into like a lot of the trouble in life.
There was a lot of tension around recording this album. This is their second one. So like they also had a lot of pressure. So I'm glad that, you know, it came out as authentic as you're saying it is. Like you can hear that it's a real album. Bert is quoted as saying like, it was tense. There was a lot of arguing and headbutting. Everything that went into the record, me having lost two friends, tension within the band and tension with our producer, it was mostly positive because it all made the songs come together like magic.
Yeah, I heard that it was like, I'm self-admittedly, Bert was like, I'm not an easy person to work with when like dead set on something, which like, again, relatable. I'm like, I know this is the right thing to do. And you have somebody being like, I want to do this. It's really hard to get out of that mindset. And I can imagine like, you know, it's like anything. It's like, how are you supposed to say this is the right way to do art, you know? And it's a really thing that you have to like fight for. And so knowing Feldman and knowing Bert, I'm like, fuck, dude. Yeah, I can imagine those two, you know, personalities really being
clashing, pushing a lot. I think Feldman pushed them a lot on this album, but ultimately, like, it came out fantastic. You know, it's a really, really incredible album. I think it's also interesting, like, they were just on such a big high coming off that first album. They were a big deal. Like, Bert was dating Kelly Osbourne. That sold, like, 100,000 records alone, just him being on the show. Well, like, that show was big.
It was the first reality TV show?
Yeah, and everybody was talking about it. And Bert was just on there being fucking insane. And that was good reality TV.
What was the, like, I remember they bleeped a name for him everybody couldn't, like, figure out what it was.
Well,
and
it was something like, it was about him having, like, an STD. We talked about this.
Yeah, we did talk about this.
Nickname the Osbournes.
So I almost didn't shower for this podcast.
Cauliflower dick.
Yeah, like I kept trying to be like, what are they bleeping out? You know, at the time, and I could never figure it out because it's not like a normal swear, not like a normal thing that you would bleep out on TV. And
well, they were just throwing in unnecessary bleeps, like on Ozzy, on the whole thing. Like he would just be like bumbling, and they'd be like beep beep beep. And it just like made it funnier.
Truly,
you know?
Amazing he's still alive.
It's crazy.
Like it's wild. And I like, again, honestly, like I believe that drugs and alcohol like pickle you. And like,
Bert looks great now. Dude, he's like so ripped.
Yeah. Like that, like I truly believe if you do like drugs and alcohol in your like younger years, you're like, oh, you're just like, you can handle anything that life throws at you. And it like makes you stay in that like young.
Yeah.
Thing.
But that like made them famous. That really like launched The Used, I think, with that first album. And then they went home to Utah and they had all this pressure and reporters were like, how are you going to write the next album? And their response was like, we're going to go to Utah and we're going to jam at Brandon's house. Like that was what they did. Just taking it back to the roots. Being from Utah and like growing up in this scene, The Used definitely meant a lot to me. Because I was like, oh, fuck, those are guys from Utah doing this. And nobody makes it out of Utah. Nobody.
It's like Jimmy with me.
I found this quote from Dia Frampton, who's also from Utah. And she was talking about driving around the first time that she heard Thursday and then the first time that she heard The Used. And she said, growing up in Utah, I listened to country music, Dixie Chicks, Shania Twain, Tanya Tucker. The rock scene exploded for me when I was 15, around 2002. I started dating this guy. His family was Mormon, but he didn't believe in the religion. He showed me this band in his car called Thursday. We were driving around with a few of our friends in his really shitty car. It felt like the doors were going to fall off of it if you closed them too hard. We were just blasting Jet Black New Year, jetting down this tiny religious town that felt like the walls were closing in around you. this song made me feel cool for the first time. Sometimes when you like a band, it makes you feel cool. And then Riley showed me The Used. So, like, that's how I felt, like, listening to The Used. I mean, you've been to Utah with me. Like, imagine you driving around Morgan, Utah. Like, you're growing up there in this, like, religious bumfuck nowhere town surrounded by extreme religion being shoved down your throat all the time. The pushback to that religion is going to be so much more extreme. The way that I can describe the scene in Utah is like in New Jersey, the rebels are rebelling against like normalcy. You know, they're rebelling against like having to go into a blue collar job or like even a white collar office job. They're like, I'm going to be in a band. Hell yeah. In Utah, being normal is already a rebellion against being religious. So in order to rebel from that side, you have to go like all the way over here. So then you have like fucking crazy hardcore straight edge kids beating the fuck out of people, like so much to the point where like the Utah cops called straight edge a gang.
Yeah, I remember they got labeled as like a got labeled as a gang.
And that's kind of where Bert came out of. Like that's where all these guys came out of. They're Mormon kids, and that's why they're so good at instruments too. We'll come back to that. Bert was a rebel against religion at a very young age, was having so much tension with his family, and started joining these like hardcore shows, and he was kind of like so preachy. He was a straight edge hardcore kid for a couple years, and he was preaching. Like he would hand out zines at the hardcore shows, and then he smoked weed and he got kicked out of his hardcore band, and then it was just like, then you just fucking go.
Instant cross punk. Like he gives
He went really far.
Dude, he gives like when he first came out, like like any like crusty dude that like is kicking it on a sidewalk in any small town is Bert, you know?
Oh yeah.
And like very, very relatable. Once you put something in you that makes you like get out of yourself and makes you feel anything different than how you feel, you want more of that thing. And that's what happened to Bert. He was like, oh, an escape from this, you know, like the straight edge hardcore thing is like, that's, you know, you only go so far when you're when you really are trying to escape. And once you can make yourself legitimately feel different, because it's, you know, it's like, it's this fear of the world. It's this ego that you have. And it's like, I'm the best, but also the worst at the same time. You know, they call it an egomaniac with an inferiority complex is like a really great definition of like a drug addict and alcoholic, which yes, you know what I mean? Like, I understand that. It's like, sounds like an insult, but it's the way to describe how a lot of us feel. Where we go, we walk into the room and we go, why, like, you want everybody to be like, oh, this is the best person in the entire world. And then when they say you're the best, you go, I'm really the worst. And then when you leave, they go, why isn't everybody talking about me? And then you leave and then you go, I'm the fucking worst. You know, it's like this constant battle of thinking you are truly God's gift to everything and believing that you are the worst thing that has ever existed. It's such a polarizing place to be. To have that just get taken away, that's why heroin is like the best drug for somebody like that, because it just goes, imagine just so much noise around you all of the time and then, you know, for your entire life, and then that noise goes away. That's what that's like. And so, like, you know, it's weird. Like, I get it. Like, I get all of the stuff and I get all of the shit because you have their band trying to get you to be better, and you're like, but I don't know how to be better. You know, it's like, that's also how you deal with your art. You know, like, I don't think I can make art if I'm not like this. When the truth is, you know, you make better art when you aren't like that. It's just like, you can't get to that side. But I really like, he was the first guy in this scene where I was like, I relate to. I like more than anybody. Like, I really, like on the Osbournes, on all this shit, like, I was like, that is the fucking guy that I looked up to as a rock star, you know, as opposed to like what a rock star, what our parents would consider rock star, and what, like, you know, the world considers rock star. I was like, that guy, that's the guy. And he sounded like how I wanted to sound. He screamed like how I wanted to scream. He wrote lyrics how I wanted to like write them. It was just, you know, he had it in the fucking bag for somebody like me.
In 2005, I think a lot of the stuff that you're talking about really sort of came out. You know, this album came out towards the end of 2004, and then they were on the Taste of Chaos tour in the winter of 2005. So like right after this, you know, that was like right after to My Chemical Romance put out like Three Cheers. My Chem and the Used previously, like before both of those albums, they were just friends. They were just like besties, like Quinn and Mikey. They were hanging out, drinking all the time. Bert and Gerard are a famous duo. They would just fuck with people. Like they would kiss, they would hold hands. They would just, it was like a shock value thing. And like the early 2000s be like, oh my God, two guys kissing, you know? My Chem started blowing up while they were on Taste of Chaos, and The Used was the headliner, and they were kind of like always used to being the headliner, especially with My Chemical Romance. And it was like this weird thing where like Bert would be like, I'm the king. Like he had that attitude of like, I'm the king of this, you know?
Sounds,
and like,
sounds right.
My Chem would come out and give it like 105%, and then Bert would like dial it back to be like 95%. And every night it would be like 5% less because he's like, I gotta do nothing because I got it. You know, I'm the king.
Literally, what did I just say? Yeah. You know, like the, like an egomaniac with an like it's like you're like, I don't have to do anything, but why don't you guys love me?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of that struggle for a lot of years. So when we talk about like why isn't The Used like at that level of respect or like superstardom?
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, some of the personal decisions that Bert and the rest of the band struggled with over the years.
And you know, you made a really good point, like taking that break. Like that's a strong point. Like I think all the decisions that led up to where My Chem is and where The Used is now, like those, all of those play into it. You know, it's not just like one thing. I think that all of the, like those two things are probably the truest of why it is the way it is.
Should we talk about the beef since we're talking about My Chem and The Used? Did you get this one?
I didn't get this one.
Okay. So it's all about the Under Pressure cover. If you guys don't know,
it's fucking awesome.
It's great. It's a cover of Queen's Under Pressure. It's The Used and My Chemical Romance, and they recorded this song, this cover for Tsunami Relief for like some sort of compilation. The Used reissued this album in May of 2005. They put on Under Pressure without asking for permission. They were like, we're just going to do it. And they were like, no, we only did that for Tsunami Relief. And then The Used was like, well, we're just going to do it anyway. And that caused big beef between My Chem and The Used for a long time. Did they ever squash it? I don't know.
They did.
Did they?
Yeah, dude. I mean, at least in my, you know, the interviews that I've...
They squashed?
...listened to, you know, recent, like in more recent years, like pandemic years... Bert only speaks really, really highly of that, you know, and I think it's also like a time and place where I, at least from what I gathered, it feels like it. It felt like it. Now on the other side,
we don't know,
but I can confidently say half of it has, I think, squashed that beef.
Sure.
I don't know. A lot of the other stuff that, like, I was listening to with Bert, like, I love, like, he feels the same way about me as a lot of shit. He, like, hates social media. And he, like, hates, like, I think it's just a fucking cesspool of, like, I listened to this really interesting story, and it was around the time of the pandemic, and, like, he's been, like, you know, in my eyes, I think that this scene has been, like, outspokenly, like, for lack of better terms, liberal, like, accepting, and, like, very, you know, whatever, come as you are, really, and no judgment situation. And, like, right around the time of like, right before the pandemic, like, I guess he got in, like, some fucking, said, like, some lady on stage, or in the front of the crowd was, like, he, like, made some sort of comment where it was, like, if you don't want to get pushed around, like,
get in the back.
Yeah, like, I mean, and so, and I get on this fucking soapbox a lot where it was, like, we can't, you know, how are we supposed to know everything that's going on with everybody all of the time, like, he said it like way, way better. Every person is like, you know, can't know every person's nuances, all of them all the time. And he was like, I think we should all just like, how I feel, just like respect what everybody else is going on, but you can't put that on anybody else. You can't like,
I think you've made the analogy before. I don't know if it was on the podcast, but you were like, it's a recipe for beef stew. And then like somebody in the comments is like, great, this looks delicious. Can you make it for a vegetarian? And it's just like, no. Scroll on. Like, this is a beef stew recipe.
Yeah. It's not for you.
You can't accommodate everybody's things.
You can't accommodate. And, like, I think that knowing how accepting, like you said, back in the fucking, when he was with Mike, he was, like, out, like, kissing dudes and being all weird. That goes to show that that's where he comes from, is, like, not giving a fuck and all this stuff. And then we, like, move into this world today where it's, like, wait a second. I never cared about this stuff, and now you're, like, making things up for me to, like, care about and, like, saying I am this person when that's not what I am. And that, like, I resonated with that, like, so heavily. And I was like, now I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Him just being like, fuck social. I was just like, dude, this guy is, like, so parallel to, like, my thinking besides, like, the poem shit. You know, like, I'm not a reader.
I felt like there were multiple times on this album where you could tell that it was like a poem that he was trying to fit into a song. It just felt like he had the lyrics first and then he was like trying to shove in all these like syllables into certain places. And you're like, okay, maybe it's just not going to work.
Well, I listened to the interview with the fucking, also very, 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 very big shout out to Jeff Howard, who's the bass player.
Oh, Jeff. Like, J-E-P-H.
Awesome. Like, literally probably my favorite bass playing on...
Except for Eben.
I fucking love that guy.
It is good bass playing, dude.
It's awesome. But he was saying that, dude, there's just a poem, you know, like you said, that was, like, trying to fit it into songs, and then there's, like, one that just didn't. And it was, like, you said it as a poem. Like, fuck it. We're gonna just, like, play it as a poem. And it, you know, people would start reciting that poem... In general, like as
small,
a song,
simple,
like
safe as
exact, like, yeah. You know, people would just start reciting that, and it became a thing. And I listened to a lot of reviews thinking that, or saying that, like, that was, like, I don't know, cringe. And like,
but that was part of it. Like, Fall Out Boy does it too. Like, that's part of this whole scene, like being into poetry and being like deep and lyrical.
I don't think it's like, and that is another thing is like, I believe it when these guys do
it.
I believe it when these guys do it. And that's what makes it not cringe. Yeah. If you just look at it as face value, you're like, you're saying a poem on an album. Like, yeah, sure. But if you believe it, then nothing is not cool. Like, if you think that it's cool, then it is cool. And I think that The Used really did that with this album, because they're also like, you know, they got lumped into like screamo, and they're like, I don't know, we grew up playing with fucking ska and metal, and like, we're just a rock band.
Well, going back to Jeff's bass playing and just the overall musicianship on this album, I feel like there's a lot of really interesting instrumentation. Like, there's upright bass, you know, on one song, and you're like, how do you know how to fucking play a fretless upright bass, dog? And like, Bert has piano credits on this album. There's like weird glockenspiels and bells. A lot of the songs are like kind of experimental. They're like trying stuff. There's like one in like 6/8. They're actually like really fucking good musicians. And I think that if there's one thing that I can highlight about, you know, Mormon culture for people that are unfamiliar, it's like all the kids in Mormon families like have to learn an instrument, you know, like that's like a normal thing. Like, you start them in piano lessons, like very young. Like, you look at like when we talked to Cove, like he started singing so young and was like always singing in choir and singing with his family. That is just something that it's like a cultural thing that I know, like from being from Utah, where people are like, how are they so good? And I'm like, well, they're fucking ex-Mormons. And like, they're all good at that shit.
So that is something that like I put down here for sure. Like the songwriting on this album, and that look, this is what I wrote. I'm just writing it. I'm saying it. The songwriting in this genre is sometimes, for lack of better terms, bad. You know, it's simple and bad. But it's like, that's what makes the song good, right? But the songwriting on, you know, specifically on this album is very, very good, in not a way that feels trying to be like, I'm going to write this in 6/8 to write it in 6/8.
Right, yeah.
Like, it feels really like great song. It takes you through like whatever any dumbass music critic would be like, it takes you through ups and downs and through valleys and hills. And it really does that. And that's like what I like. I know that like a lot of, you know, people really like a lot of lyrics, and I listen to a lot of melody. He is so miles ahead melody wise for singers in general, but especially for this scene. It was simple, but like maintaining this catchiness that feels, it felt like it should be simple, but it wasn't simple.
I think the marriage of Feldman and The Used is something that is extremely rare and should be studied. Like, he got something really special out of these guys. Do you know the story about how they came together?
Was it the drummer was like a super, like the drummer, like
Brandon was a big fan
of celebrities
of
in general.
Goldfinger.
No, just
oh,
of
really?
Yeah, I heard he was just like celebrities in general.
Okay.
And fucking just would like take pictures with
okay.
all of the celebrities. So okay. like he would just send this to the celebrities.
He was actually like a big fan of Goldfinger, and he would like follow Goldfinger. He was one of those fans where he followed them so much that the band knew who he was. Goldfinger was playing this festival. I think it was the X96 festival in Salt Lake City. And he saw Feldman through the fence and was like, Feldman, here. And he handed him a tape and had his phone number on it. The next day, or maybe it was like a few days later, but Brandon was at the airport dropping off his brother to go on his Mormon missionary trip. And he gets a phone call from Feldman that's like, hey guys, like, I love the fucking demos. I want to fly you out to LA. I want to record your album. I want to bring you out on tour with Goldfinger. And like their whole life just fucking changed. They didn't believe it because they had already been faked out once. They went up to Sundance in Park City and they met a guy who claimed that he was like in The Offspring. And it was just
like when I was in rehab, my guy
claimed to be
in train.
Yeah. Exactly. So the fake Offspring guy was like, I love your band. I want to sign you. And they had all gotten like excited about that. So when this Feldman thing happened, like they were like, okay, sure, Brandon, whatever. But it was fucking real. And they had never like left Orem, Utah before that. Like they got on a plane and came to LA and Feldman picked them up in his BMW 3 Series. And they were just like these wide-eyed kids looking at PCH and being like, where the hell are we? How did this all happen?
It's interesting that you like say that story in particular, because I listened to something with Bert and he was like, dude, I just like don't know what it was. There's so many stories going around on like how we met Feldman that I kind of, you know, he was like, I know it was the drummer. Like, I know it was the drummer that did something, but I don't know how it was.
This is from Brandon's mouth.
Then it probably was true, because Burr's probably all fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't remember shit. You know, like, so I would probably be like, I don't know, TJ did something. And you're like, know exactly what you did. And I'm like, could be right or wrong. You know, like, and so it's really funny that you got that one, like, the legitimate one. And I listened to Bert and he's like, I don't know, I think this happened. Maybe there's a lot of stories, you know, which is really, it's like a lot of
stories in the world.
There's a lot of stories in the world.
Do you remember how Bert used to throw up a
yeah.
lot? That was like his thing.
Yeah.
He was the throw up guy.
That's the thing. It's like so cool to me. That's like so cool to be just like so.
Just disgusting and just puking and like on the show, like shooting snot rockets and shit.
Like just like, so cool. Like to, you know, it also like kind of speaks to like that rebelling against like how much can I, you know, it's like Gigi Allen-esque where it's like, but that was all Gigi Allen sucked. But like, he's like literally like the worst songs I've ever heard in my life. But like, you know, it was like awesome that he ate his poop. You know, like that's the cool thing about it. But this guy could like, you know, Bert is different. Like there is a fucking immense amount of talent in addition to being disgusting. And to me, that was very, very cool.
What are your standout tracks?
Dude, I don't know. You put on this fucking album like right away. Like right away. These albums that we've been doing, like I got who The Used was with the first song off this album, Take It Away.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like Take It Away is more reminiscent of the first album than it fits like with the rest of this. I feel like it kind of bridges from the first album to this album. Like this album's definitely more diverse in song style and like it's more experimental. But like that song feels like it could be on the old album.
Yeah, I like that.
It's cool because they win their old fans back immediately.
Right. It did the thing for me.
Like hooks them.
Yeah, it did the thing for me. And that's like what I'm saying. It's like it really like It'll like be a motherfucker, and then it'll take you, be like, all right, this is a softer thing, and you love it because you already know that they did that. Yeah. And then, I mean, look, I like All That I Got is a great song. And then I really like, I'm not a humongous fan of covers. I think that this one, this cover and
Under Pressure.
Get Up Kids did a cover of Close to Me that I think rival the originals. And it's rare when those things happen. I listened to a cover of, there's another cover. Oh, when we were doing Jimmy Eat World, there's a couple of bands, you know, remain nameless, that did like a cover of like Bleed American and stuff like that. Or like, you know, they're big now. And I was like, this just doesn't do it for me. Like it just, you might as well have not done it. And these, I feel like, are necessary to the song. Like they do something different, you know, than just like being like, all right, let's cover this song.
I think it also captures the lightning in a bottle that just was Bert and Gerard. Dueling powerful forces coming together on one track is undeniable, especially like a song like that.
Something that not, you know, we re-record two in a day, and something that the dude from fucking Seinfeld, what was the band name?
Silverstein
said that Shane from Silverstein said, it really like stuck with me. Because it's something that, like, I believe very, very, very strongly. You know, when you're in a studio, and I guess with any art, you could, it might be the correct take, but it might not be the right take.
Mm.
Like, everything might have been there, and everything might have been on key, everything, it might be perfect, but it is not the right take. And I think that Feldman did that with this album. Like, he had a really fucking strong ear for being like, this is the right take.
Yeah.
This is the right way this sounds.
Yeah.
And I know that like Feldman gets like ripped a lot for like overproducing sometimes. And I don't think that this is the case with this album. I think it was like done the way that it should have been done.
Absolutely. I agree. My favorite, I love All That I've Got. Like that chorus melody is crazy.
I mean, it's like, I think all, like, really, the melodies on this album.
Sad. I didn't even know this. All That I've Got is inspired by the death of Bert's Chihuahua.
Oh, that's sad as hell.
Yeah, his Chihuahua was named David Bowie.
That sucks. I hate that. I don't like a dead dog song or a dead dog movie, which is interesting that you say that, you know, because what we go into next is like, if you like this, you might like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I like kind of couldn't think of one. And then one popped into my head who also has a dead dog song that I hate and skip past it, but it's such a good song. But the, like, I don't know, maybe I'm trying to connect the dots here a little bit, but I put Pup. Like, if you like The Used, you might like Pup. Like, I feel like they give that, there's like so, the melody and the way that the instruments sound and the energy that is given. I feel like, I don't know if I'm reaching, but they also have like a dead dog song there. I'm like, stop, don't play that one. Cause it's in like a row of incredible songs. Pup is truly fantastic.
Dude, if you like this, you might like that. I don't think I even put anything. Because, like, I don't think that anybody does this
I agree. And that's why I'm saying I might be reaching a little bit.
Nobody comes close to this.
I might be reaching, which is an incredible compliment. Like, what a really great compliment.
Like, I looked at the related artists on Spotify, and it's just like, no. These are in the same scene, but, like, nobody can hold a candle to The Used.
Yeah, this, you know, and I know that, like, our former business partner, Babs, this was, like, she fucking shit her pants over The Used. Like, this was, like, her favorite fucking band.
Like, maybe AFI.
Maybe. It's not the same. It's, like, not, it doesn't
have this, like, raw emotion.
Yeah. I thought of AFI, but it's also, like, people know AFI, and I was, like, maybe, how, I don't know, I feel like I've been trying to reach in a way where it's not identical. But it is true. Like, I had a really hard time with If You Like This, You Might Like That for this. And I think that that's a really huge testament to who The Used is. But I also just really want to shout out their bass player. I think he's fucking awesome. And he's been in the band.
My name's Jeff.
I think he's been in the band like the same amount of time. And he dresses cool. Like, he's always just been like a cool guy. Like, I think he's cool.
I think that's about it. That's all I have to say about this album. Do you have anything?
I don't know, dude. I probably do have a lot of stuff to say about this album, but I'll leave it out because...
We have to talk to Feldman.
We get to talk to Feldman.
We get to talk to Feldman. That'll be fun. We've talked to him, but never about this album specifically. Morgan, you know him pretty well.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to him.
It'll be a good interview.
You guys, hold on one second. Ghost Energy, for when you stop doing heroin and then now you need something else to do.
All right.
That's a good ad.
You think Bert likes Ghost? How could he not, right? It's so good.
It's the best. He has to like it. I don't know if he... No, he drinks coffee. He's got to drink coffee.
He probably drinks Ghost and then hits the gym.
Yeah, he's pretty ripped now. Yeah. You know, he said actually after like, you know, trying to get over addiction, this is one thing he did say that I didn't agree with about addiction, but he was like, you know, you got to find something to fill that space. And for him, the first time when he stopped, it was books, obviously. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, at least for me, maybe that worked for him, but like trying to fill that hole with something else, it's not the right thing for me. It wasn't the right thing to do. Like if I was just
books
like
or the gym.
Book. Here's what happened.
Or both.
Here's what happened. Books. But for Bert, as he said books the first time he got off drugs. He was like, I just filled it with like reading all the time. And he was like, but that's like a really isolating
right
thing. You know, here's what happens when most people get off drugs and they have no sort of like program to follow. They go, all right, I'm getting really into the gym, gambling, or fucking.
Because
those are things that like weak, yeah, and for food. You know, yeah, some like
things
are
that reward you,
but like that aren't that. And I think that, you know, trying to replace one thing with another is not the way to do it. So if anybody
here,
if anybody is, you know, going through it, you know, talk to me.
Dr. Bob's Nightmare.
It's so funny. It's the fucking best title for any chapter whatsoever. I actually think I might be able to make it to one of these things that got out in time.
Maybe you'll see Johnny Feldy. Okay, everybody, thank you for listening to CD Burners.
I'm excited to hear what you guys said that we got wrong.
Here is John Feldman.
Dude, thank you so much for doing this. This is a it's interesting to talk to you about something that you did a while ago and through your entire like discography and career. It's an interesting thing to kind of pinpoint. So I'm interested to see your take on this whole thing, which is, you know, the Used album.
We're talking about In Love and Death today.
I love it.
So it was the second one you did with them, I believe. It's a really great album. We had a really fun time digging into it and listening to this album. I mean, the songs are incredible. There's so many different styles, so much fun instrumentation. It felt like you and the guys really created something magical, and it felt like the band kind of really came into their own on this album. One of the things that I read about a lot with this album was that there was quite a bit of tension in the studio between you guys and the band. And there was a lot of tragedy surrounding, you know, Bert's personal life. Coming in as the producer on this project, how was it dealing with all of that and everything that was going on with the band and the tension that was happening in the studio?
Yeah, it's a lot, man. I mean, look, I found the band, I guess, late 1999. I mean, I got them signed to Warner Brothers as my own deal as an A&R guy at Warner Brothers, working with Tom Wally through Guy Oseri. So it was like a seminal moment in my life as a kind of music executive. You know, they really helped me. I had already had a deal at Maverick with Guy, and the Used kind of transitioned me over to Warner Brothers with Tom Wally, who ended up A&Ring the record with Craig Aronson, the In Love and Death album. So, you know, there was a lot of history. And look, Brandon Steinekert like really fought for me to get my deal at Warner Brothers. Like he was kind of the business guy in the band back then. It was like, you know, Bert and Quinn were the creatives, and Jeff was always kind of you know, kind of like a hippie in the best of ways. He was very kind of hands off, and Brandon really ran things. And so as much tension existed between Brandon and me during In Love and Death, because it was really him and I, to be at least in my memory of making that album. And it was never anything where it came to blows or anyone was going to quit. I mean, Bert's always, you know, was a little bit elusive when it came to like his dedication to the art versus his dedication to his drug use and to, you know, personal issues he was having at the time. But, you know, it is interesting. I mean, just to kind of close the door, like on the Brandon thing, you know, when we were about to make the third album, Brandon was really running charge of getting me off the project, like trying to get me, you know, kind of fired as a producer, which, you know, Quinn and Bert were never, I mean, I'm sure they had thoughts of working with other people, but they always kind of had my back. And it is interesting to see some of these interviews that happened with Brandon post record, you know, since he hasn't been in the band. I never had anything, but I mean, look, some of the headbutting that Brandon and I had made this album as interesting as it is. I listen to these drum sounds, and Brandon had like three kits set up, like the big kind of John Bonham sounding kit, the rock, like real tight kit, and then the little hip hop kit that he had set up. And so we were constantly trying to chase the best drum sounds we could get and always trying to be as creative as we could get. And part of it was the time it took to get these drum sounds was a lot of the headbutting that Brandon and I had. But in the end, we made, I think, a timeless record. I was just thinking about, you know, Mark McGrath. I mean, Matt Pinfield may give Mark McGrath a run for his money, but Mark may be the most, you know, as far as a musicologist goes, like the smartest and most knowledgeable guy I've ever met is Mark McGrath from Sugar Ray. And I remember we were at a New Year's Eve party right after In Love and Death came out, maybe 5 months after, at Gwen Stefani's house. Not that I'm – let me drop a couple more names. But
yeah, you got it. Let's keep going.
Yeah, let's keep – and he said, whatever happened, he wasn't paying attention to this one. He goes, whatever happened to that band they used? They had all this buzz about him on their first album. And then what happened? And in my head, I'm like, you're not fucking paying attention. In Love and Death is a seminal album. And I didn't know at the time it was going to be their biggest album. But to this day, it's their biggest album. And as much as we butted heads and all the shit that went down, Bert's girlfriend dying, his dog dying, all that shit that happened, we made a classic. You know, to this day, I stand by that.
I agree. Wholeheartedly. I agree. You know, we listen to a lot of albums. We've been doing a lot of albums, and you know, the first sounds you hear on this album, you're like, oh yeah. And like I say, and I tell this on the podcast, cause we record the podcast and then we do the interview, but you know, there's this, connection that you can hear, especially for somebody like me, where, you know, I was hearing a lot of things that I thought sounded fake. And from the first sound that you heard on this album, the intro to this album, I knew that these guys meant it. And I knew Bert meant it. And I knew that it was recorded in a way that spoke to me in a much different, sound than I've heard, you know, my growing up. And so to me, I could tell instantly that this guy was real. And the way that you produced it was different than I think that I had heard anything, you know, cause these songs went on radio. So these songs went on radio, and I had never heard songs like this on radio before. So, I mean, I kind of want to ask you about a little bit about the production stuff, because like, you know, look, I could be wrong. I'm always wrong. This is the podcast of misinformation, but were these guys the first outside of like ska that you produced?
I mean, I had produced Mast, I'd produced Show Off, and you know, I produced a couple local bands, but the Used were the first band that really connected on a global level for me. They were the band that put me on the map as far as a producer. And I mean, there's no question, you know, I owe so much of my career to these guys allowing me to produce so much of their music throughout the years. And I cut my teeth learning. I mean, I really learned Pro Tools. I learned how to edit. I learned how to, you know, sample, replace. I learned how to do all that stuff, making making the used record. We were all learning together. Those guys had never made an album. So we were all doing this as a team. And it was really exciting, you know, working, you know, we'd work these 20-hour days. We'd be going to bed at 6 a.m, starting work again back up at noon. And it was like, and on the first album, we were, you know, taking all the kitchen appliances out, throwing them at Bird at 3, 4 a.m, and just doing really, really creative stuff, which we did on In Love and Death too. There wasn't like, Brandon was insistent not to do any sample replacement on his kit. So we didn't like, there was really no drum editing on that album at all. I mean, you can hear it, and it's just, people don't make records like that anymore because you don't have the time. I think it took us 4 to 6 months to make that album, and you just don't have the kind of budget or time to be able to be in the studio with the amount of people it takes to make an album now. And look, I take my hat off to Brandon for really being insistent on having live drums on a recorded album, you know?
Well, that snare sound on All That I've Got is like absolutely insane. It's like the tightest snare that I've ever heard. Not to get too dorky, but it sounds really fucking good. And to kind of go back to what you were saying, like since this was the first sort of project for you that put you on the map, kind of a two-part question. What was it in the demo that you heard, if you can describe it at all, that really drew you to work with this band? And number two, could we get some final clarification on the story of how you received this demo? Because I've heard a few different stories. I heard that Brandon handed it to you through a fence at a Goldfinger show. I heard Bert drunkenly stumbled in and threw it at you in the bus. I'd like to hear the definitive answer here.
Well, yeah, two-part question. Bert, you know, Bert is the answer to question one. It was like, I'd never heard anyone sing like Bert. I'd heard AFI, I'd heard Poison the Well, I'd heard Refused. But I'd never heard anyone that sung like, I mean, I guess there was a Michael Jackson element to it because his voice is so high, you know, that soprano that he has. But I never heard anyone with such a pop tone. His voice is so pop. And all these hardcore bands that I had heard that had kind of done post-hardcore and screamo, like the beginning stages that probably existed. I mean, I don't know. I think Shape of Punk to Come came out in 96. So it had been out for a couple of years before we made album one. And you know, I think, I mean, look, Brandon and Jeffo was singing in the first incarnation of The Used. And I had heard their music through, I think they had camped out at Mojo Records because that was the label that Goldfinger was on, and Brandon and Jeff were Goldfinger fans. And I'm not sure, I think Quinn was, I'm not sure Bert was on any level. So Bert didn't give a shit about me or whatever. He was just like this hardcore kid that, you know, so Brandon probably handed me a demo cassette that I passed on because I didn't really get it without Bert's vocal. But the tape that Bert threw on my bus in a drunken frenzy and got thrown out by Paul Scholl, my tour manager at the time. I mean, this little guy that was probably 80 pounds soaking wet. I mean, he literally picked him up and threw him off the bus. The next day I listened to the demo that had Bert's voice on it. And that's the one that got me like really excited when I heard his voice.
At the end of these albums or at the end of these episodes, we try and figure out like, you know, sort of if you like this band, you might like this band. And until you said Refused, we had a really hard time picking other bands that sound anything close to The Used. It's like they're in sort of a lane in their own, even though they fit in with all of the all of the bands that we grew up with. It's a very distinct sound. And you know, like kind of going back a little bit to what I was talking about with you, this being one of the first non, you know, like this messed and the pop punk and ska stuff, like what would like were was there like fear there of being like, I don't know how to, is this a new thing? Like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to, how am I going to do this? Like, is this a completely different thing for me? Like for personally, was there like, I'm interested because going into a situation being like, shit, do I know what I'm doing?
Well, what do they say? You can't be in fear and faith in the same time. And I've always tried to jump both feet into faith as much as I can in all my, in my overall career. It's like, I remember at one point when, I mean, I actually made a little EP with Sonny, From First to Last, you know, before Skrillex existed. And, We did a few songs. You know, this is probably right after In Love and Death. And, you know, he really changed the scope of music. I'm sure you guys remember EDM being all that anyone listened to. It was, you know, between, Swedish House Mafia and just every, all these, it was like EDM was the thing after it was going to kill rock. And someone suggested to me, a manager at the time said, you should change your name to DJ Felchman or something, you know, fucking ridiculous. And all I've ever done is kind of gone forward. Tom Wally really taught me that, because Tom Wally, you know, who signed Linkin Park and Green Day and My Chemical Romance and like legendary Tom Petty and so many epic bands. I never once witnessed him focused on the failures. I never heard him talk about the ones that didn't make it. And I'm sure he had, you know, 30 or 40 losses for every one that like stuck, that went through and made it. And I really learned so much from him, to the idea that like it's going to be okay, and to live in faith and to say I love my life whether I mean it or not. And making that used album, the first used album, was definitely like an experiment. Like I said, all of us were in there. And I know The Shape of Punk really influenced Quinn a tremendous amount. And I know AFI really influenced Bert a lot. I mean, there's a picture with, you know, Davey screaming at some little, you know, VA hall with Bert right there in the front when he was a little kid. So, I mean, they have their influences, but no one had the same influences that the Used have. And the way that Quinn used his Green Line 6 pedal for all those like insane Radiohead sounds that Quinn came up with, I just never heard any of that music. And a lot of the times all I had to do was push record, because those guys had a, you know, they had a vision, and it was my job to kind of rein in for every 100 ideas Quinn had. I had to pick the 2 or 3 that were going to make the song. Like, I mean, Take It Away, it's just like that riff that Quinn had. I'm like, that's the beginning of the record. Like I knew what it was going to be. And, and it was kind of like my job just to take it and put the pieces together to make the songs that were already there with all their ideas.
This is a big question for me, because everything that we do, whether it's you know, failure or success, I always go like, what can I learn from this? And, you know, from doing this album In Love and Death, you know, and your career moving forward with how fucking incredible it is, dude, like really, like looking at all of the stuff you've done is at least to me overwhelming just to look at. And so like from this album, what, you know, like what did you learn? What did you learn from doing this album?
I mean, look, Bert was the great lesson for me, because I mean, he witnessed Kate dying. He witnessed Bowie, his dog, dying. And both of those, I mean, Bowie was like, he always had this dog with him as his best friend. And look, I'm not trying to compare a human life to a dog's life, but I've lost dogs, and it's the most tragic, one of the most tragic things you can go through. It's the loss of an animal like that. And he went through both of those within a month of right before we started this record. We actually had to push back starting the record because of these tragedies that happened in his life. You know, the idea to witness Bert showing up every day, no matter what he was going through, it gave me strength to say, you know, if this guy can go through it and create the kind of art, like all that I got was written about Bowie, and that became like probably the biggest song on the record, I think it is. And the way that song came out, it's just like I get goosebumps. And it's the one song whenever I go see a U show that Bert pulls me up and has me sing with him. So I know that the creation that we came up with on that song together is magic. And the idea of just sitting in your own space, no matter what is going on in the outside world, and just sitting there, not getting up and running away, but just sitting there, is so much of the lesson I learned making that record with Bird. And a lot of the people, like he brought in that guy Sean from Coalesce. I'd never heard Coalesce. I didn't know. I mean, I wasn't like a hardcore kid. I grew up on punk rock, and it was like he brought in like this guy, and I'm just like, who the fuck is this guy? But he's like a legend in the underground movement. And then he opens his mouth and it's like this guttural scream. I'm like, how are we going to put on Lunacy Fringe and all that I got along with sound effects and over dramatics on the same album? But then Bert, you know, reminded me that I told him Blackbird and Helter Skelter are back to back, you know, on a Beatles album. And it's like, if they can do it, we can do it. And that was, you know, he reminded me of that lesson. So
taking it back a little bit to the ideas that you said that, you know, Quinn especially was bringing to the table. And there's a lot of like creative choices, I think, with the instrumentation. I think, you know, there's like toy pianos, and I read somewhere that he had like a vibrator on the guitar at one point. Like, were these all the just things that like he brought to the table, or were they things that just like kind of happened in the moment, or was that more coming from you being like, hey, I have a glockenspiel over there, let's try that?
I think it was a hybrid of both. I mean, Quinn is I don't know. He may have the most raw talent of anyone I may have ever met, as far as just like born with this gift. And the way he plays guitar, I've never met anyone that plays like him or has that ability to just create, like give me goosebumps and make me want to cry and laugh at the same time, the way this guy plays guitar. But, you know, to contain him and to make, you know, a 3-minute song out of his style was the challenge. And so I would always like, I can't say for sure where the vibrator came from, but I know it was, those guys didn't bring it from Utah. I'll just say that much. It wasn't, they didn't bring it with them. So when we would come up with these ideas, and I think there's a clip like on the first album of me, we had this moment that we were going to make this, you know, make that I was this hard ass producer and make this video clip where I was like this brutal guy to work with. And I locked Quinn in the guitar room where just, I, you know, my first studio was like a teeny room that we had everything set up. So I had to do drums with headphones in the same room the computer was at. So we were always fighting the noise of the computer while we were recording vocals. And, I'd lock Quinn in the closet and he was getting feedback on this one song on album one. And I opened it up. I'm like, you're not doing it. We were filming it. I'm like, you're not doing it. Yelled at him. And Bert came in, and Bert wasn't in on the joke. He was like, what the fuck are you doing to Quinn? Like, it was so great. And I've met so many people in bands that have seen that video clip on YouTube and have been legit scared of me because they think that's who I am, which is fucking classic. But look, after the first album, before we made this record, I mean, Bert was dating Kelly Osbourne, and we had, and it didn't, you know, it didn't end up being, they were meant to be together. They broke up, and it was probably under unfortunate circumstances. But at the time, and probably to this day, Sharon Osbourne was like the GOAT of all marketing and promotions in rock music. You know, Ozfest, like they were on Ozfest, and it was this huge thing. And, you know, the rumor was that Sharon was going to cancel the band because Bert broke Kelly's heart. And so we were going to radio with, I think it was Buried Myself Alive, and it was like, it got canceled. Every radio station dropped the song. So we were going into album two with all this kind of, drama, like, you know, like what's going to happen. And the band on the underground, and like they were, you know, we were selling out the Palladium and doing all this amazing stuff on a live level. But as far as radio, we had a little bit of it with Taste of Ink, you know, that went kind of big. But then going into album two, we're like, what the fuck is going to happen because of this drama? So it was a lot of stuff to manage. John Reese was their manager at the time, and he did a fantastic job. But, you know, as far as like recording, sorry to go off on a tangent, but recording Quinn was just like, we would go in there and it would just be Quinn and I for 3-4 hours. And I would just record him on a click. I would just put a click. We say, we need an up-tempo song. We need a ballad. We need a fucking fast song. And I just put a click up and let him go. And then him and I would go through it and just pick these moments. That's the chorus. That's the verse. This is the lead. By the time he would be done, it would just like, it was wild how creative this guy was. He would just go, go, go. And the line six green, he would have these guitar parts on loops that would just go, and he'd play on top of himself. And it was just, he would create this soundscape that I'd never witnessed before or since.
Dude, you mentioned the Osbournes thing, and it kind of, I kind of forgot about all of that stuff until like really looking back at this and, you know, looking where you were at with your career. Was this, you know, like, were you like, was this the first time you're like, oh shit, I'm in like kind of like a really, really, really public A-list spotlight situation. Like, you're like, oh my God, what the fuck do I, you know?
Yeah, it was really exciting, man. And I mean, and I got to tell you, I mean, just talking about it, you know, I'm like I've said, I'm so grateful that these guys trusted me with making the records that I've made with them. But Bert would always, every show, because we took them on their first tour they ever went on. They'd played like a couple backyard parties, but they hadn't been on tour or anything. And Goldfinger let, you know, we had them open for us on their first tour they ever did, you know, before Ozfest, before Taste of Ink, before any of that, or Taste of Chaos, before any of that stuff ever happened. And he would always say, no matter how big the crowd was, John Feldman discovered us and we owe it all to John. I mean, he'd always say that every show I went to, and no other band I've ever worked with is like really kind of like, giving me that kind of, I don't know. It just, I always felt like I was part of this, part of the band, which it felt like, I mean, I don't know. It warmed my heart so much to feel like what I did with this group was not just getting them signed or producing a record. It was like part of all of it. Like you just said, like the idea of witnessing, you know, Bert dating celebrities and, you know, all the band, and Bert discovered My Chemical Romance, got them signed, all the stuff that happened. Like I always felt like I was a part of it, even though a lot of it, I was just an outsider looking in. It always felt like I was right with them, you know?
No, I think in the history will show that you are a part of it, you know, whether you felt like it at the time or not. And so it's been really, I mean, honestly, this is one of the cooler stories and the cooler albums that we got to do. And, you know, I only have like one more personal question to ask you. It's, you know, in the studio and dealing with somebody like Bert and then somebody like yourself, like, how did you separate that, and how did you deal with when things started to get it, or if they got out of control? Like, were there times, I don't know, you know, I have to deal with this a lot now being in doing what we do, and I've got a way to do it, but you're kind of more confined and working in a more creative space and for longer hours and can't leave.
Yeah. Look, when it comes to like, you know, I don't do drugs or drink, and I'm not a straight edge guy. I do it because it's, you know, life or death for me. And so I think that this In Love and Death project was a perfect example of me, you know, putting my recovery first, you know, always. And I really, album one, Bert was very aware of my lifestyle and how I live my life. And he never disrespected me in that way, that when he was doing heavy drugs and really going off the deep end, it was never around me. I know he was on the road. I know he was on days off in the studio, but in the studio, he was always focused. I'm sure he smoked some weed, and I'm sure like once in a while he drank, but it was never like the heavy drugs never happened. And look, they say, you know, we don't go in the dark to rescue these people. We stand in the light so they can see us. And it's like, it was never my job to rescue Bert. You know, it was my job to, you know, stay clean, stay sober, and be the light. And, you know, Bert hasn't done, you know, any hard drugs in ages now. And his life has definitely transformed, and he's got, you know, kids and a wife and a very different life than he had when we made this record, which was like, I mean, his life was chaotic back then. And it was like they came off the biggest year of their life on the self-titled record going into making In Love and Death. We were like, how are we going to one-up that? Because they have their whole lives to write these riffs and these songs. And then we had 6 months to write In Love and Death. And so, you know, when it came to Brandon being so hardcore, I mean, the Splice didn't exist. I mean, we weren't taking loops off the internet. We weren't like looking for 808 or snare sound or a trap hi-hat on Splice. I mean, we were creating every sound from scratch. Everything on that record is made from scratch. I mean, we recorded the strings at my house, the orchestration, you know, Jeff on Lunacy Fringe played upright bass on it. We would rent out these instruments. I mean, I had this vintage C12 AKG microphone that was like a $15,000 mic, and Bert would like I wanted to have this vintage sound or this modern record we were making. And Bert would, he'd scream so hard. He would, you know, we had the trash can next to us so we could throw up because he'd be screaming so violently. And he would spit on the microphone. He'd get a little bit of spit on the capsule and it would kill the mic for like 2 weeks. We couldn't do vocals because I had to fucking get it clean from the one guy in LA. And he fucking died during that album, the fucking mic cleaner. We had to buy another one. So it was like, we really took this record very serious about how we created those sounds.
Dude.
Love it. Incredible, well, thank you, man, so much for getting on the CD Burners podcast with us, Mr. Feldman. Appreciate it. It's been super insightful. Thanks for all the creations that you've put out into the universe, especially this album. It fucking changed music forever. And I know it changed Morgan and I's life and probably our career. I don't know if we'd be on this call, or, you know, we're looking back on 10 years of emo night. I don't know if that would exist without the Used either. So yeah. Thanks, dude. Appreciate it. And hope you have a great rest of your week.
Yeah. Thanks, boys. And
dude, and thanks, man. Like, I, you know, out of all the stuff you've done, I really, really look up to you for, you know, the first thing first through it all. So throughout all of the years I've known you, it's awesome, man.
Thanks, boys.
Thank you, dude.